Have you guys ever used or considered using Kickstarter to fund your games? Just wondering, because I know you guys would have the sickest slash wildest slash dream come true backer rewards. Please. I have $3,000 to spend, and I want an adult size. I want an adult size Snuppy suit.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 107 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the programmer of programs.
I'm Sam, and I put vectors on things.
And today is July 18th. 2017. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show. We're gonna say some bad words. Mm-hmm. I'm just gonna be real about it. All right, we good?
Mm-hmm. We're also gonna think bad words.
We're gonna think them.
We're gonna think them right now.
We're gonna be making really rude gestures as well. So you might hear some like middle fingers flying around.
You hear this? Listen,
it's chaos over here. All right, so we got some news this week. For starters, this is the 28th prime number episode. So congratulations, everybody, on that. Also, we are in the midst of Spearmint Summer. So let's talk about it. How's it going? What is it? Hit me with some details, brothers.
Yeah, so just to recap, Spearmint Summer was our way to shake it up this month of July and a little bit into August.
We decided to become spearmint farmers.
Yeah, so
it's been going pretty good.
Gum, yeah. You know? But basically what we decided to do is we re-engineered a few of the things about our workday and just did a bunch of thinking about how to maybe work better, maybe not. That's why it's an experiment. So yep. What we're doing is 4-day work weeks, which we had our first one last week. And then on the fourth day, which is Thursdays, we have a jam day, which is a 12-hour day, which some people might be groaning internally at that. Some people might be very excited about that.
It's awesome.
It's very awesome. So we had our first one last week. And it did seem to go very well, even to the extent where, so Thursday, about 8 o'clock, basically is when the factory whistle blows at Butterscotch on a jam day, and everyone starts kind of wrapping their stuff up.
And by factory whistle, it means Sam just screams at the top of his lungs. it is very effective.
It's shrill. It's alarming. Ripped from my work.
Yeah.
So everybody's, you know, writing up their stuff, and then we had a little postmortem afterwards, as we always do. And it was interesting because everyone said, I mean, jam days are always good. We know they're good. And the amount of energy everybody had actually at the end of the day, we had discussed going to some local a local event for game devs in town that started at 8 p.m. on that Thursday. We had talked about it in the morning, and everyone's like, "Oh, yeah, I don't think I'm gonna have the energy to go." But the interesting thing was at 8 at night, after working for 12 hours, everyone's so jazzed that I know Andy was talking about it. He's like, "I might just need to go to that thing." Like,
although did he though?
I don't know if he did. But he's like, I'm not going to be able to sleep. And then, I mean, I felt it too. I went home and
but that was the funny part is I think as soon as, in like 5 minutes after the workday ended, then all of a sudden the ennui crept back in and everyone's like,
I'm going to bed.
Well, I mean, what happened to me though? Like I had a really hard time sleeping because I was still just like.
You've got the residual crackling energy of the jam in feels your like veins.
You're just swathed in energy.
Did you touch Diana to shock that residual energy out of you and then into her so that you could go to sleep?
Yeah. Well, so what I actually did is I sort of tried to carry the jam forward, but just into my life. So I before bed on Thursday night, I took a notebook and just wrote down a bunch of the things that I wanted to do the next day and the rough order in which I thought I'd probably do them. And then woke up and I did all of them. There's 17 things planned out in a day.
So you surfed the jam wave.
I surfed the jam wave into my personal life, which was amazing. Nice. So it was great.
I wanted to, but I had to go to the DMV.
So your jam wave just kind of ran into a cliff and just kind of dissipated immediately.
But it was kind of it's an interesting sort of juxtaposition though, right?
Of
being in a workplace where you're just fucking crushing it and everyone, you know, is
enjoying
what they're
doing. Then you go to a different workplace, which is what the DMV is.
Yep. Where it's because and Jenny and I were sort of, you know, musing about it while we were there about how it just seemed purposely designed to be the worst experience.
Like not just for the people, but for everybody,
for the people working there, for the people that make the rules, for the people, like you every piece of it, you couldn't have designed it to be a worse experience. I don't think you could have.
I think the one thing would be like, you know, at Walmart, you come in and there's a greeter. Yeah. The DMV, if there was a face puncher, like you just walk in, you get your face punched, and then you can stand.
It would have been more interesting. Like, yeah. And we walked in.
I guess it would have been more interesting, at least.
It would have been much more interesting. But we walked in and one of the little ticket things, you know? And so, and there's green tickets for one thing and pink tickets for the other, but the signs are like hard to find and they're not actually where the tickets are. And one of the machines wasn't even on the wall anymore. And instead, there was just a sign there that said, go to, they said, go to the driver, the driver desk. I was like, what the fuck is a driver desk? You know? But apparently it meant the desk that is only for getting your driver's license, which isn't labeled, right? But there's, they also put it, it's behind a pillar so that when you walk in, you
can't
see it.
Can you not just detect the authority? Can you not just feel it and hone in on it like a pigeon?
So crazy. And, but then to top it off, because of how, I mean, this is, you know, every state has their own bullshit when it comes to these things. Actually, weirdly, when we were living in Texas, everything was very easy. So I don't know, like, it doesn't have to be this way.
It doesn't have to.
But Missouri in particular, it's extra whack because of also how they do property taxes on vehicles and stuff and how they do their tag system for, so there are all these extra pieces of things, which in the end still adds up to like three or four things you have to bring, right?
Also, you got to spend a lot more time at the DMV in Missouri than you do in other states. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of number of things that you have to do throughout the year that you got to go hang out at the DMV to do.
And for some reason, you got to be there in person for a handful of them, even though they're things that just don't...
Internet exists.
My favorite was they sent me a pin to renew my stickers for my license plate.
And then it didn't...
And then it didn't work.
Didn't work, yep.
And I was like... What are you doing?
So I had that same problem. Here's the thing. It doesn't work the first time you use it. If you wait a week and use it again, then it works.
So you tell me that they don't put it into the system before they send you a letter?
Yeah.
Give me a break.
I feel like what they want to do is they want to recreate the feeling of being in the office.
It's just, you know, part of that mission they have to frustrate you every turn.
So they send you the pin, and then there's a time delay where you have to wait in line for a week, basically, on the internet now to get your...
We know where the real villains in society are.
But where are they? Where did this
Who
come from?
Who designed this? Well, maybe that's the thing. Maybe nobody designed it.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly...
Talk about this whole idea of being thoughtful with
legislators said, here are the rules. And then they said, now let's make sure we don't want to pay any money to implement these rules. So we're gonna set aside the lowest amount of money possible.
And then they appointed a committee.
And they appointed a committee. And then that committee then had to hire some people from the private sector because only the private sector can accomplish things, right? And so then they had to take competing bids. But the only point that they care about is how cheap it is. Right. So now you compete for... Literally, they're competing for who's going to do the worst product. Right? And this is how our entire fucking government runs, right? Like, think about the highway system and stuff too, right? Or like any building thing. They compete on is price. Yeah, how insane is that?
There's a report that came out that was Australia got ranked first for healthcare and the U.S. got dead last of developed nations.
Like, are we a developed nation? Is that even a fair category?
Who knows? Who knows nowadays?
We are, but you know, we're all...
We're stringing
to politics. We don't spend very much time at the doctor, that's for sure.
But yeah, so the first week experiment summer went very well. Giving us back a track here. And second week, we've been kicking off and everyone is super zoned in. So the big question we had as far as, you know, a 4-day work week and a 3-day weekend was, is it the case that when you come in on Monday, you have only a vague recollection of what the hell you're doing?
You've kind of fallen behind, or will you just be actually more ahead because you felt like you had more time to stay caught up? And
well, there's an interesting thing that happens. So I think the first week was definitely going to be probably the most turbulent in terms of getting into it because everybody's still coming off of a 2-day weekend and coming into a 4-day week. Now that we've had the 3-day weekend and now coming into a 4-day compressed work week, I think what is an interesting thing that we're starting to see is basically because people have now had the 3-day weekend to, like, you've got the Friday then to take care of your life stuff, like the DMV, which you normally wouldn't have been able to actually do.
Nope.
So you'd had to try to find a way to like leave work or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that just adds a lot of extra stress trying to figure out how to compress all of your errands and everything into your 2-day weekend when things are generally not open and all this other shit. So then you're trying to compress that. And then you also want to try to get a little bit of like hobby time or whatever. Learn how to like make a new type of joint for your tables or whatever it is
that
you do.
For your flesh golem in your basement.
Yeah.
How did you
make some new reinforced elbows for your flesh golem, right?
it's just a hobby.
Yeah. And there's stuff you want to do on the weekends as well as taking care of all your errands. And oftentimes it's just, there's a lot of juggling that has to happen. So
can't do it all.
So it seemed like coming in on Monday, everybody was just much more relaxed.
Yeah, it was very... Everyone was laser-brained.
Everybody just settled in, just like 8 o'clock, boom. It was just... You just heard the furious typing on the keyboards.
We forgot to talk about this. We had corporate Monday yesterday.
Yeah.
Because we're no longer an LLC. We are incorporated.
Yes.
So we're a corp. So...
Doesn't mean we're publicly traded or anything like that. Just a name change, basically.
To sort of goofily celebrate this, Monique... I think half joking, just suggested on Friday that we should, you know, dress up.
You mean on Thursday?
Thursday, right? Whatever day it was, the end of last week, that we should dress up on Monday, you know, like we're in an actual corporate office.
It's corporate day.
And so I was like, I'm down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Tifa, also the artist, was like, I'm down. And so
I was down in principle, but it turns out that I have embraced our lifestyle so hard that I no longer have any
wearable suits, clothes of any sort.
So, yeah.
Whoops. Yeah. Whoopsies. But yeah, so I was driving into work. So it's like
with your suit,
5'10". I'm decked out in the one suit I own, which I wore to my wedding and I wore to Dice. Those are the two events that suit has been debuted at.
And now corporate day.
And now corporate day. And so I come around the corner and I see this very well-dressed, professional-looking woman walking down the street with like a nice handbag. And I was like, well, that's weird because Seth just lives in a neighborhood. And I was like, oh, that's Tifa. So I pulled up next to her and I said,
well, she normally has a hamburger backpack.
Exactly. It's a cheeseburger backpack. Yeah. So I pulled up next to her and said, get in the corporate van. And so she hops in. Both of us are laughing, coming to work. And then Mo arrives. And Mo's decked out in like a green blazer. Just looking so corporate. Excellent. people wearing pearls, you know, just looking good. And then we have this hilarious riff. Seth made the joke that it's as if it was Halloween for us, where everyone sort of started acting like the character they were playing. Right.
So people talking about like their golf game and like working on their short game. Yeah. And, oh, I had to fire my gardener this weekend.
Yeah. My stocks are down, but I'm going to buy a boat anyway.
Investments. Am I right?
So it was fun. We had a good time.
Yeah. Also, we have Pixel Pop coming up. So let's talk about that. Pixel Pop. Mm-hmm. What is it, Adam?
It's a thing when you're like, you're looking at a thing on a screen, right?
And yeah.
All right. So it literally explodes, throwing shards of electricity into your eyeballs.
Right. So that's one definition.
But I think you're talking about Webster. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I think you're talking about the thing that's in 3 weekends from now.
Yes.
August 5th and 6th.
August 5th and 6th.
Correct.
Yeah. Which is, this is the fourth one? Fourth annual?
Third or fourth? I don't know.
Fourth.
It's the fourth annual Pixel Pop, which is was founded originally by you know, our buddy Carol, who worked in the studio with us a while ago, and some a partner of hers that I don't think I've ever met before. Mm-hmm. Actually,
he's very shadowy.
But yeah, so they found this a few years ago, and the goal was basically to kind of create this local event where people who were just into games and people who make games and could basically kind of meet each
other and
kind of see both sides of that. So it's been going for a few years. It kind of grew a bit and they're trying out experiments every year to try to make the thing bigger. So this year it's August 5 and 6. I'm not sure where it is, but it's in St.
Louis. Don't know.
St. Louis, I think it's St. Louis University.
Could be.
Head, maybe.
Just Google Pixel Pop. But why are we talking about it?
Because Adam's giving a talk.
I'll be giving a talk there. Sam, I think, is giving a panel.
I'm giving a panel and then I will sit on it.
You're on it? Are you running it or on it?
I will answer questions directed to me and none other.
You just sit there stone-faced until a question gets directly asked to you. I'll
answer as few words as possible. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Just grunts.
And so, yeah, Adam will be giving a talk about
uncertainty and how to live with it.
Tentative title:
The Fog of Life.
The Fog of Peace.
No, Pog of Peace. That's what it
fog
was.
The Pog of Feast.
The Pog of Feast.
Yeah. This will also be the first Pixel Pop that I am not speaking at.
Or just at, period.
My annual 3-day weekend retreat happens to coincide this year. So my bad. We'll be there. Sorry. But if you do want to see some of our crew and stuff, I think we're quite a few of our people are going to be at Pixel Pop. Yeah,
we'll probably kind of go en masse.
So come on over. Come check it out.
Yeah, there's some after parties and stuff, and you'll see. You'll basically kind of get a sense of the local dev scene here, which is kind of a fun thing to check out anywhere. So it's a worthwhile thing. So if your calendar is free,
tickets for $20. Weekend. It's cheap, easy, fun weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
come do it.
All right, other stuff is going on. We've been working on Snuppies, which is, should we say?
No.
All right.
We can't yet.
So it's definitely not called Snuppies. We think we know what the name is going to be.
Right.
But we got to do some research to make sure we can have it.
Yeah.
That's one of the tricky things about naming things. Not only do you need a good name, you need a good name that somebody else doesn't have trademarked in your domain.
Yeah, it's the username problem.
And ideally one where the website is available so you can just go buy the website with that same name.
Right. Yep. So there's a lot of considerations. Unfortunately, you can't just name a thing anymore.
But I think it's also why you see all the startup companies just start like hacking vowels out. Because they're like, you're not going to get, you know, like.
You're not going to get Flickr.
Exactly.
Like, as an actual word.
So you just take out the, you're like, fuck it.
Were they the first ones that did that? Where they were just
I think they were Tumblr and Flickr. Yeah. First ones I remember doing it.
You can also do stuff like find a domain that has like the ending of your word in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then put like, you know.
Those have always confused me. I think they're good, but I always get a little bit confused.
I think the problem is that most other humans, like just anybody outside of
tech generally.
Doesn't understand that anything except for .com exists. A few of them understand .net and .org, like a little bit.
Yeah.
But or .gov. But if you tell somebody, hey, just go to my awesome website .ninja.
Right.
They'll be like, what?
So is that like an email address?
Understand. I mean, I did the same thing with her when she gave us her resume, you know, for every mm-hmm. day we brought her on. Her email address, I'm not going to tell you what her domain was, obviously, but the prefix was email.me@, right? Mm. Which is also what I did
email
a long time ago.
Meet?
Dot me.
Oh, dot actually, me at.
At the at
oh,
sign.
Not the word.
email.me.
Email.me, which is also I had. But the interesting thing was when I would hand my business card to people when I would meet them, they would look at it and they couldn't figure it out. They just absolutely could not. They were like, so what's your email address? I'm like, it's fucking
email me.
It's email.me. It's like
at my web domain.
It says it right there, you know, like it's just written out. But for some reason, they couldn't
interesting
get it.
People need to open their minds.
Yeah.
To so alternative
I don't know. I think someday this is all going to work. But I think for now, it's just cute. And I think the people who are like really trying to take advantage of it, like these brand new startups and stuff with their silly apps mm-hmm. and things. To me, I'm just super amused because they clearly don't understand the markets they're trying to reach when they're using these like .ninja domains and stuff. Like, nobody's going to understand what you're doing.
Right. Yep.
Quit being cute, you know?
Yep. So we've been working on it. We've been cruising forward on the game. Mm-hmm. It's evolving quite rapidly. Yep. We're learning a lot. One of the things that we are learning is, so this game is very AI heavy.
Yep.
Because it's a turn-based sort of battling strategy game.
That does mean that Elon Musk is going to want us to have it regulated.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
AI regulated?
Yeah. He gave a talk a few days ago to a bunch of state governors.
Oh, yeah, I was reading about this. Yeah. He's terrified of AI.
Yeah, so he wants people to start putting regulations on it.
He's like, well, what did he say? He said, I've been exposed to the cutting edge of AI, and I cannot believe that people are not just terrified. because of the potential that it's a life threatening thing, not because of like death, but in terms of all of our way of life, right? Everybody will be out of work. He's like, there's absolutely nothing that a person can do that an AI could not do better eventually.
What about love?
Even that.
Damn.
Yeah.
The robots took it all.
Absolutely nothing.
Yep.
The thing is, they just have a love switch. They're just like, boom.
I'm in love.
I feel it. I'm a robot. but this is an interesting problem because we have a strategy game where basically a strategy game is all about sort of making deliberate choices that matter, right? So if you think about there's games that have sort of looser strategies. So if you think about a game like Pokemon where, you know, you have your stable of Pokemon and you have your set of moves, but you're kind of locked in, right? Because you've taken a lot of time to level it up. Mm-hmm. And so if you have like a water type Pokemon, then your strategy is if you come across like a grass type, then you just like use a lot more potions and hope for the best, right? Right. Or you got to then spend an extra 10 hours grinding up a fire Pokemon or something mm-hmm. to compensate. And so you're a little bit locked in. And so your strategy,
it's simpler, actually.
Your strategy is very simple. And so you're just gonna be like, all right, I'll just tackle them a bunch. And, yeah. You know,
I mean, I think a better example as far as kind of where the game's going is actually looking at the AI required for a game like Hearst.
Yeah. Right?
Or any sort of deck building game where there's a lot of weird combos and a lot of weird cards that could get played at any one time.
Yep.
Because what ends up happening is that if you play against an opponent that is dumb, that makes, especially if the game is sort of tightly constricted like ours is, where you can tell if you make a wrong move that you've lost the game.
Yeah.
You can kind of,
well, it's not like Pokemon where, so you've got your six, right? Mm-hmm. You got your one powerful one. And if this turn, instead of using tackle, you used like headbutt, you know, then it's like, well, you know,
whatever.
They all pretty much do the same shit, just to different degrees. Mm-hmm. And so you're still inching the opponent's HP down to zero. In a game like Hearthstone or in a game like the one that we're making, you don't have those loose, those sort of loose associations of things. And just one decision matters. And so by having the AI, like, so we're trying to balance the game, and the AI is still not even close to good enough that we are getting good, sort of good matches mm-hmm. out of it, which does also mean that if we want to make multiplayer, you know, we don't have this problem,
which is great,
but it also means that we don't actually understand the game because we've never played against a good opponent. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, so this is kind of where we're at in development is really having to sort of double down and take the time to make the AI really good. And then we'll scale it back. So if we want to have easier opponents and stuff, yeah, we can make the AI dumber for that.
Yeah, it's easier to add stupidity than it is to add brain power.
Yeah, basically. Which is kind of a hilarious thing to think about. Which is like if you're playing against like in a chess game or something, right? And you're setting the computer on easy. The computer knows. It knows what the best move is. It just purposely doesn't do it. It's right?
Like, whoops.
Whoops, I moved my pawn instead like when of
you
my
go
queen.
When you go on a date with someone and they want you to like win the game to feel good, right? They're right. Like, oh, wow, I made such a blunder. It'd be terrible if you took advantage of it.
Because the only way the AI can have degrees of difficulty is that it knows the right move.
Right.
It just chooses not to do it, which is kind of demoralizing, you know, if you think about it.
It's letting you win.
Yeah.
Plain exactly.
Yep. And cool. Then otherwise we've got a couple more things. So one is we've been working on our always know why studio philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's just the idea that the most important thing to do as a person in order to sort of become more powerful and to understand more about the world is to try to always understand why things are happening. So think about the context of going on around you, about how your actions are affecting other people, about whether you are doing the right thing or whether you could be doing something better. And this all comes down to context and sort of having a deep understanding of where you fit mm-hmm. and where your actions fit. And so I don't know if this is something we wanted to talk about, but there was an article that we came across.
Yeah, I think it'd be really good to link it. It was frankly one of the best articles on just thinking work that I've ever read.
So in this article, there was a discussion about how there's this weird sort of dichotomy in tech where there are tons and tons of freelance tech workers who you can go to elance.com or whatever. And there's this kind of race to the bottom for price where there's all these people who will say, yep, like whatever kind of, programming, software development, whatever you need, we'll do it for like 10 bucks an hour, $5 an hour, whatever. And oftentimes these are in like other countries and stuff like that. But the fact is it's very, very cheap. But then on the flip side, you've also got programmers who work at companies who make like $200K a year as software engineers and architects and stuff. And so effectively,
and companies are constantly struggling to find people for those roles.
Right. So it's weird, right? So there's so many people providing these services that there's a race for price, but then also
There's so few
of them.
There's a race for a salary.
So what's happening? And so the point that this article makes is that really when a company brings on a person full time, what they're bringing that person in to do is not to solve the cut and dried task list type problems that you would hand to a remote worker, where you say, here's what my problem is, here's what I want, just do it, right? And they just do it because really they're just kind of, they're solving already solved problems just in a way that's slightly, you know, unique to your particular situation, right? In a larger company, what that person's being paid for is not going down a checklist and being handed a task list. It's they're supposed to be immersed in what's happening in the company, and they should be, most of their work is even just figuring out what problems to solve and finding new problems and sort of baking in the context of the studio or the company or whatever. And then they apply their problem solving techniques to those things. And so this kind of comes exactly back to what we were talking about last week about the importance of always being aware of what's going on around you. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of value that you bring to the table. I think
the author of the article refers to it as deep context, which mm-hmm. is just like truly understanding what it is you're doing and what it is that the problem is that you're trying to solve. Because the truth is, and we've even seen this internally with as we've brought new people on, oftentimes the first way someone will solve a problem, if they're actually lacking context, even if they think they aren't, they'll solve the problem, but it's the wrong problem, right?
Yeah.
They sort of, you get off on something.
Or they create new problems.
Yeah, or you create new problems and then solve those as opposed to whatever the actual issue is. And so there's a lot of potential waste there. And so that's sort of what those higher salary positions in terms of the software engineers command. And also why it's sort of the dichotomy is interesting, because it's the author basically just makes the case that most of these problems that you want solved are not as simple as just saying, make me this widget, right? Mm-hmm. Once you understand the deep context of the storefront of the business behind it.
Well, in fact, the software that you're making to solve the problem is no less complicated than the problem itself, right? And he throws out some specific point talking about some guy who worked as a software designer for like freight logistics or something for like a decade, right? And he's talking about, here's just a random tiny sampling of the kind of weird stuff this guy knows that actually goes into making decisions about how to design software. Right. And it's like the fact that certain kinds of things cannot be sent by air, have to be sent by ground, right? And like the impact of different
knowing
days
which kinds
of, week,
of things those are.
Knowing which kind of things those are, so that when he's designing software, he has all this stuff in his brain. And we recognize this too while we're working on stuff. When we're putting pieces of software together, so like when I'm building a website, I'm thinking about all the things I know about related to, caching things and scalability and how the underlying technologies work that I'm using, what our players are actually using it for and why, what the game is using it for and why, right? And each one of those things itself has 1,000 little tiny problems and nuances that I only know some subset of, but somebody just coming right in knows literally none of those things.
And even if they are a good programmer, that doesn't mean that they can actually solve any of these problems.
Yeah. You're better off being a medium programmer with a much deeper understanding of the problem than a great programmer without an understanding of the problem.
I think it's an interesting thing because the description the guy uses to describe sort of the development of software in this, what essentially becomes an iterative fashion where you say, okay, here's the problem I'm trying to solve. You take one step forward toward it and you unearth this huge field of small problems to solve instead of the big one, right? Because that's sort of what a big problem is. It's just this combination of tons and tons of small ones. And then through the solving of all of these, I think he calls them micro problems or micro obstacles. That's sort of where you start figuring out the context and actually understanding what the problem is itself. And it's the best description actually of game design that I've ever seen, or just design generally speaking, which is hysterical because it's written by, it's like an Amazon software engineer.
Yeah, well, actually, this is the thing that was most interesting to me because I was talking with to Jenny about it last night. Because I thought it was interesting because this guy gave this just like beautifully nuanced argument explanation for the value of context and all this, right? In the context of software development,
right?
And he referred to other people's kinds of roles related to this, right? But somehow he missed like this one essential step, which is that software development isn't special.
This is everything.
It's just literally everything.
It's just solving problems where your tool is programming.
Exactly. But for any role related to literally anything, because all of us do, like our day to day, whatever it is we do, it doesn't matter. That thing is solving problems. That's what we do. We just have a particular domain in which we are solving problems, and we have a particular skill set that we're using to solve them. But there's no difference in how to approach it, whether you're using software as your tool
or hammers,
making games, or using hammers and making a house, right? There's actually no difference in how you need to approach those things to apply those things. There's a general problem solving strategy, which has to do with the more context you have and the more nuanced your understanding is of the problems and of the tools, by far the more effective you can be as a person solving problems, solving that kind of problem.
Yeah. We'll put a link up to that article. Cause I think it's just a must read.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah. And I think as kind of a final note, I mean, this kind of comes back to, we always talk about how we believe that we are not good game designers. But we also have a hard time believing that anybody's a good game designer, because the assumption is that to design a game, people talk about having a game design document where they have this several hundred page thing where they write out everything that's going to be there in the game. And then what happens when they start developing the game is most of that document gets invalidated almost immediately, right? Because they lack the context. So, we're talking about this AI problem, right? And how, as we're working on this game, we're learning all kinds of things about how we need to approach developing it. And as we develop it, we learn more about it and about the kinds of problems that come up. And so we're just kind of working our way through this fog, and we're discovering all kinds of new things. And there's just no way to know what kinds of problems you're going to run into or what kinds of new ideas you're going to discover based on the thing you've already made.
Well, it's because the problem and the solution are actually not separate entities, right? And I think if you treat them as just separate, then you're just in for a bad time. You're just going to have trouble. And it's also that's when you divide up the roles in your company, where you say, okay, here are the people that invent problems. Here are our managers, right, who decide what the problem really is. And then here's the people, you know, our team of whatever, salespeople or developers, whatever, who actually now implement the solution, right?
Right.
No, that's just not how.
So you're actually doing yourself a huge disservice by trying to split up those knowledge domains.
Yeah.
Right. Because then you basically have one person who doesn't understand how to solve the problem.
Right.
And another person who doesn't understand
how to diagnose the problem. That I think you can get relatively broad and deep knowledge of the problem domain while still specializing in one solution domain.
Right. Having extremely good communication skills and good buddies.
Yep.
Is the best way to make really good stuff.
Well, and giving a shit about the context, right? Because
that's
important. It doesn't matter how much you love writing software,
right?
Assuming you do, right? But if you write software for a living and you just love the shit out of it, it doesn't matter at all unless you also love understanding the problems that you're writing software to solve. Because otherwise, yeah, you're making beautiful software, but who gives a shit?
It's useless.
It's useless.
Because it's not solving a problem anybody cares about.
It's great at being what it is.
It's art.
More so.
Exactly. Well, it's like if we meet somebody who says, hey, I've been developing my own game engine. Well, that's nice, but why?
Why would you do this?
Yeah. It's doing it for the sake of doing it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other important, aside from giving a shit, the mm-hmm. other thing is you have to be willing to move even if there are a lot of unknowns.
Yeah.
Because you can't be paralyzed by being confronted with this fog. Because the way you uncover the fog is by just starting to like wade through it, right? And then you'll figure out what to do. So, you know, sometimes you'll take missteps and you'll go the wrong direction for 2 weeks.
We refer to it as flying onto the rails of discovery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Off the rails of progress. And onto the rails of discovery. Life is a very crazy train.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So we got one more news item before we get to questions, which is there's something about popcorn.
I don't know. This is great. So, all right. So last night... Story time. So last night,
paint me a picture.
Last night, I'm sitting in my living room with two friends who came over, and Diana, you know, bounds in. She's like, "You guys want some popcorn?" Because she just made popcorn for Game of Thrones on Sunday and remembered how good it was. So she puts like all these crazy spices, just like a shitload of cayenne pepper. I mean, like if you breathe this thing in, you start coughing.
I saw on Game of Thrones night. I saw you guys trying to eat the popcorn,
and coughing,
and like choking and coughing.
Right.
So I ended up not partake.
But the thing keep in mind is like, so it's kind of like, it's basically pepper spray applied to popcorn. Delicious. So Diana's all excited. Everyone's like, yeah, we'll have some. So she disappears in the back room or into the kitchen, and the kitchen and the living room are right next to each other. So one door, doorway between the two. And we're just out there chatting. And then a couple minutes go by, you hear the popcorn popping, stops. And then we heard Diana shake it because you put all the spices in and you shake it. And then it was just silent. And Diana starts screaming, which of course she does a lot. And so the problem is it's like sort of a boy who cries wolf.
Yeah, thing. You can't, you know.
So she's just like, And then suddenly she goes, Sam, I need your help. And I was like, oh, shit.
She stopped screaming. So something is serious.
It just got real. So we leap up and run into the kitchen, and she's standing in the middle of the kitchen. So like very far away from where the popcorn is located, and just bent over and is just blinking like repeatedly, and then just has her eyes shut and just like is screaming. And I'm like, what is happening? And she's like, I got it in my eyes. And so I'm like, get to the sink. And so basically just like grab her. And like, it was an interesting point as far as.
So she pepper sprayed herself.
She basically pepper sprayed herself because I grab her and put her head in the sink. And then we use the sink sprayer thing. And I'm like, open your eyes. I was like waterboarding my wife.
I washed her.
I washed her for a bit. And then we're like, what happened? And she's like, I shook it. And it just like shot that pepper mixture into her eyes. And I'm like, how? You had the lid on. And we go, and there's a hole. Like a pressure one.
Yeah.
So there's a tiny single hole.
So she literally pepper sprayed
on
herself.
The first shake.
Because it was just steamed.
Yeah, it was steamed. And then she had just put all of it in there. So it was just, the spices were all sitting on top. First shake, just ejected
So just kind of puffed out of the hole.
It just directly
like a laser beam of spice.
Incredible. Yeah.
Spice laser.
Very exciting night at the Costner Zing household.
Yeah. Is she okay now?
That will never happen again.
Maybe.
So, you know. Yeah. Now it's put the spice in, shake it around sort of horizontally, let the spices settle.
Yeah.
You know, cover that hole.
Don't shake it vertically because then it slams the spice pile against the lid hole, and then you get spice.
Yeah, it's funny. There's like But actually, this comes back right back to deep context, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's a thing that now she has learned. She has hard won that piece of knowledge, yep. right? That none of us knew.
Oh yeah.
So and any of us could have done that. Nobody else knows this except for those few people who have injected spice into their eyeballs. Yeah. Right?
So now if she says, "Hey, I'll teach you how to make some of this popcorn," and then that person's going to grab the handle and start to shake. She's going, "Wait.
Check if there's a hole.
Check for that lid hole. Point right. that away from your eyes because yeah. you will spice laser yourself right yeah. in the eye."
Well, that's the point is all of us, none of us know all these little nuances of things mm-hmm. that we don't know. You know, it's those, you know, those Dick Cheney unknown unknowns. You know?
Yes. right. There are unknown unknowns.
And having that, trying out all kinds of stuff so that you end up with these broad experiences and then giving a shit about what you're doing and then thinking about what you did after the fact. Like once you combine all those things together, that's how you get that deep nuanced context of the stuff that you care that about, which could be anything
from getting pepper sprayed in the face yeah. of your own. Bible, listen,
like, that's not going to happen to me now.
Yeah. Hopefully I was still, to anybody.
I didn't even know I was at risk of that happening.
Think about this
now, but now I'm not anymore.
Yeah. Right? With the thousands of listens that this episode will get, how many eyeballs are going to be prevented, you know, saved from having
yeah.
spice lasers shot
so
into
so many.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, let's get on to some You're questions. Welcome. You're welcome, Earth. All right, so these questions come from our listeners. They come from podcast.bscotch.net. So if you would like to get your question on the podcast, get on over there and slap a question in the wall box.
Yeah.
All right.
The wall box.
First question comes from Rad Habit. Have you guys ever used or considered using Kickstarter to fund your games? Just wondering because I know you guys would have the sickest / sexiest / wildest / dream come true backer rewards. Please. I have $3,000 to spend and I want an adult size Snuppy suit.
I mean,
but yeah. Here's, I want to me, this question, the way it was asked was perfect because it follows like the list of like awesome things. But what that is describing is the backer rewards.
Right. And it has nothing to do with
The thing. That is exactly why we will not be doing Kickstarter.
Yeah. Because we're in the business of making video games.
Yeah.
We're not in the business of
making whatever that onesies. Well, it could be. $3,000.
Right.
We eventually will be, obviously. But yeah. At the moment, we're still too small that, you know, if we were to do a Kickstarter, we would have to split our attention a lot as a studio.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing I think people don't quite still get as far as how much work it those Kickstarters take is it's
enormous.
It's usually like at least a month of prep full time for like 1.5 people in most game studios we've talked to. And then during the Kickstarter,
it's full time.
It's basically like shit's just on fire the whole time. And so you're losing 2 months no matter what. And so it's hilarious, actually, if you look
you
at
gotta make enough money that Kickstarter to just to offset those the
Kickstarter.
Months.
We've talked to studios who are like, yep, we raised $50,000 on Kickstarter and we spent $70,000 to get the Kickstarter
and all the backer
launched
rewards.
And the backer rewards yep. sent out and everything. So whoops.
Yeah. So we don't trust ourselves, I think, at this current juncture to be able to do that super effectively given how small our team is. If we had a larger team and we could take a smaller percentage of the butterscotch pie and dedicate it to something like running a Kickstarter, getting the back reward set up. That's definitely a thing. We've talked about it, but I think we don't want to have to bother with all of the administrative overhead that comes with doing a Kickstarter. And
which mostly comes from the back rewards.
It's all.
But there's also an extra layer of weirdness, which is a lot of times if for a game, you know, one of our Kickstarter rewards would be the Steam keys or something yep. like mm-hmm. that. Except that actually makes our launch worse,
right?
Because yep. because having if we let's say we had 3,000 people back our game, that means on launch day those 3,000 people are not buying the game. Which means
but those were exactly the 3,000 people who were most likely to buy the game on launch.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which means, so, you know, websites like Steam or Google Play or whatever, like they use these algorithms to determine what games are doing well. And they look at velocity of sales and stuff like that. And then those games that are making a lot of sales on launch day get kicked up to the top of the charts. Mm-hmm. And then they get more exposure through that. And then more people
positive
see
feedback
it. There's positive feedback loop, right? Yeah. So for Kickstarter, there's actually a high potential of if you have a really good Kickstarter, you may actually well, dampen your launch power.
Yeah, I mean, right? there's kind of actually just like there's sort of a death valley in the Kickstarter success thing, which is you need to make there's some this gray zone where even if you are successful in your Kickstarter, like you said, you might actually spend more than is what you got from the Kickstarter in order to run the Kickstarter. There's another level even further up where it might be a very successful Kickstarter, but not to the point where it would sort of cover the fact that you're inhibiting your launch to some degree. Mm-hmm. And then I think that beyond that is where you start getting into the actually good zone, which is where you have the essentially blowout.
The things. Millions of dollar Kickstarters, right. Yeah. Where it's like, okay, it's doing well enough that...
Like, you already made your money.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but...
You already paid for developing your game.
But that's also right. The level of success where, you know, that you have such a compelling product...
That you're probably
that fine, you're right. That the 10,000 people who now won't buy it on launch day will be negligible, right?
Because you could take, like, I think Hollow Knight is probably an example mm-hmm. that pulled that off, and...
They kickstarted, yeah.
They had a really successful Kickstarter. What's that weird cartoony game that still hasn't come out yet?
Cuphead,
yep. I think that one was also Kickstarted.
Yeah, I mean, time and time again, we see games go through Kickstarter and actually have what they would consider to be a successful Kickstarter. They met their goals and everything. They do get hundreds of backers or thousands of backers, and then they launch to crickets, you know. And so it's kind of...
Past. Yeah. I'll pass for
we're
now.
Good. Yeah. We actually have a philosophy of trying anytime we do something like a game launch or whatever, we try to make the biggest splash possible, which is why we do simultaneous launches and stuff like mm-hmm. that. We want to pile all of the hype and all the excitement onto one very specific moment and not spread it out over mm-hmm. a whole bunch of smaller events.
Which might be a bad idea, but
I don't know. But the idea is you got to try to catch that positive feedback, mm-hmm. right? Because if you don't, then you just... That's it. Now you're just coasting.
Now you're just low level coasting. Mm-hmm. All right. Next question comes from Retro Banana Man NL. Mm-hmm. Banana Man's really been killing it lately with all these questions. Mm-hmm. Are you planning to go to an event in Europe soon mm-hmm. / at some point? So I guess soon would be preferred for Retro Banana Man, but you know, at some point maybe.
We'd definitely like to go. A big part of it is knowing why. So.
Yep.
Most of our contacts are stateside as far as the people who have just a drastic influence on whether or not we're successful. And then on top of that, the price, of course, of flying across the ocean is not cheap. And mm-hmm. so
plus lodging, plus travel.
Yeah.
Plus
yeah.
So, I mean, it is the case that it could easily end up being if we went on a trip somewhere overseas. That the cost of doing that would actually be more than how much money we made off of crash lands in that same country.
It could be
totally possible. Be. Yeah, that's totally possible. So it just has to be for a good reason, basically.
Yeah.
Or have some of the budgeting covered for us to make it a good thing to do. So we definitely like to go. It's just a question of whether or not it's in the cards. And I think we have gotten opportunities to say go speak in different countries and that sort of thing. And most of them we've had to turn down because we can't figure out, I mean, just
how to justify the
just
cost.
Realistically how to justify the cost, especially if they're very far away, because it's like a week of knocking out a person, if not two. And then
we even did that for South by Southwest.
Yep.
We got invited to go to South by Southwest and they were like, yep, we'll give you a booth and we want you to do this award ceremony thing. And you have to man a booth. And we just said, nope, we got to make games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we, you know, if we're a year out from launch, we just don't see what that would potentially do.
Right.
We've been to conventions. We were in the PAX 10 and stuff like that. And everything we've done where we've traveled somewhere, unless we were directly going there to meet a contact, you know, who can help us in some way, or who we can make like a distribution deal with or something like that. Without that, there's just no noticeable effect on literally anything.
Mm-hmm. They're just fun, which then is a very expensive way to go.
Then it's just, they'll just go on vacation at that point.
Yep.
All right. So next question comes from Map5597. What do you guys think about open source and free software?
It's good.
I mean, I think the same thing about it. I think about commercial software mostly, which is... I'm mostly disinterested in the financial model it's using unless it impacts me in a unfortunate way. So in other words, I'm happy to pay for things if it seems like there's a good reason to, and if it seems like it's being done fairly, right? Whether it's open source or closed source. And so you can be paid and open source and mm-hmm. free and closed source, right? So for me, it's always just like, what is the value of the thing? Does it seem like they're asking for something reasonable?
I still can't believe that Inkscape is free.
Yep.
Yep.
That's insane. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fantastic program.
I think the one thing the only opinion I guess I do have is that the existence of the free and open, actually, like open source, I just honestly don't think matters for the most part in terms of like its impact on the broader community of people, except that it helps free things come into being.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the free part, like free open or closed source stuff. The fact that it exists is fucking amazing because that's the kind of stuff that allows companies like ours to come into existence.
Right.
Because the cost of bringing a company into being, or the cost of developing some product or technology or whatever, everywhere you can cut some other costs, makes it far more likely that you get to succeed. So the fact that we can use a Linux, you know, a free Linux distribution to run a server somewhere means now we only pay for that computer and our bandwidth. We don't have to pay for the operating system that it sits on, right? So now all of a sudden that becomes cheaper, meaning we can do it for longer before we go bankrupt, right?
Yep.
And the fact that we can use Inkscape, which is completely free, instead of having to pay $70 a month for a license for Adobe products.
Even Google Drive and all that. We used all that for all of our documents and everything else.
And that, I haven't
used Microsoft Office in like 8 years.
Someone sent me a Word document. I was like, what?
What is this weird-ass format?
But just open it in Google. So
yeah, and of course, what they're doing is they're emailing you Word documents back and forth, right? Like, and you say if you have 30 different attachments of the same file. Like, can we not do this?
Can we not? Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's there's an unfortunate thing though, which is that there's a huge swath of people, especially people trying to start successful businesses or whatever, who don't realize that free software can be really good.
Right.
And so they end up actually, you know, sort of shortchanging their runway, you know, risking their future because they don't realize that there's another way. You know,
this is something I was amazed when I was in law school. That there are these two online databases that lawyers tend to use to do their legal research. One is called Westlaw, and the other is called LexisNexis. And they're literally just databases that you search for, like Supreme Court cases, for statutes, so you can find actual documentation about what the law says and stuff like that. And they aren't doing anything that Google doesn't do. And all the information that they're pulling up is publicly available information because it comes from the U.S. court system, right? And so lawyers subscribe to these services. And the way they work is, so for example, if I want to search for a law about building zoning or whatever, I go on there, I do a search, and then within the next week, I get a bill. And every result that gets pulled up, I get charged for. Now, and I'm talking about cents. I'm talking about dollars. And so I kept hearing these stories about law students who had gone to intern somewhere. And one of the first things they did was they were put on a research job for a client, and they would accidentally incur $20,000 or $30,000 of costs from one of these just because they did a couple of searches, right? And then, of course, what happens is we just pass that on to the customer, right? And this is largely why it's so damn expensive for all these legal battles, is because not only are you paying for the lawyer's time, but also they're using these unbelievably expensive tools that actually don't do anything better than you. So on Google Scholar, there's a checkbox you can say, "Hey, I want to look for legal documents." And you get the exact same things for free. Mm-hmm. But since it's free, then people have the perception that it's not a professional tool and that it's not going to get you reliable results.
Yeah. In the same way that somebody would prefer Illustrator to Inkscape because
it costs $1,000.
And sometimes that's true, right? But the business, we talk about this a lot when it comes to free games and stuff too, right? Is when things are free, it does have the unfortunate consequence of making people feel like it has no value, which then works sort of against it. Except for that, there's a segment of the community who has learned that lesson at some point, that actually, especially in the world of free software, that there is really good stuff out there. Some of it's better than the stuff you can get that isn't free. But usually it's more because more dice have been rolled. So there are more versions of free things than paid things, and once you've learned that lesson, then you can actually go out of your way to try to find that. I mean, because the fact is, most of the stuff that we use, except for Game Maker, right? But, I mean, there are some things where there just aren't good free alternatives. And for those, we do pay for licenses for that stuff.
There are very few of them.
But there are very few. Most of the stuff that we use is completely free.
Yeah. So we use GIFCam to capture GIFs, which is a free thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually just found, because I've been putting together an Inkscape tutorial, and I needed something that would show my key presses visually on screen, so that people would know when something just happened that I didn't just click, but there's a ton of things happening, like a piano being played. So I just did some Googling and found a free one. And the guy said, and so the guy who made it was like, "Yeah, I know there's a couple of these that exist, but none of them are free. and most of them are not that good. So yeah. I just made this one. So here you go.
Well, I think that point to me is perfect, which is that there are many, many things that people are charging money for. But this is true in the physical world as well as the visual world.
It's confusing.
They have no right to because they've made shit. Right? And this is like, I hate going to grocery stores. I hate going to any store or just seeing ads, right? Because almost everything ever made by other people that they're trying to make you buy from them is absolute garbage and they know it.
You know? 90% of everything is crap.
Yeah. It's just stupid and frustrating, right? And this is true. This is true in the free world. This is true in the non-free world, right? It's true everywhere. But I think there's something particularly annoying about somebody trying to sell you a thing that sucks. So that's where, for me, like when I see a shitty free thing, I'm like, whatever, it's free. Who cares, right? And so I think my sort of general attitude towards like the free software space is just more positive. Or when I look at like the licensing terms of Adobe products, it makes me want to just like find an Adobe person and just like shake them, you know? Like what? Because it seems so anti-consumer and anti-customer, right? Because it doesn't need to cost what they're charging. It just doesn't.
You're going to be able to edit photos? Well, I hope you're ready to take out a second mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. It just doesn't need to be that way. And they're operating as the way that normal businesses do, right? Which is make as much money as possible. And I think to me, that's where, as soon as you end up in that territory, that's where I get unhappy about things.
Now, one thing I love about Game Maker, about Yo-Yo Games, mm-hmm. is they haven't yet done the thing where, because you're a business, your license for the same software is 10 times as expensive.
Right. Yeah. Enterprise license, license, yep. Right. And sometimes you also get more stuff for that. Right. And that then I can understand. So you look at like Dropbox, right? Dropbox is an enterprise level, or LastPass as an enterprise level, which of course for LastPass, it costs $24 a year. But what those usually do is they include now like these various permissions, right. level additions. They add, you know, management of an employee base. They add other kinds of stuff that a normal user wouldn't need.
That makes sense for a business.
That makes sense then to have to spend more money on. But yeah, but it actually is the case that like if you look at or take
Unity. Unity does this. Yep. Right?
Or like WingWare, which is a Python IDE that we use. There's like a free version and then a pro version and like a business version.
Business version.
And then so fucking often that enterprise version is not different than actually any of the other ones. Everything is just the same.
They're just like, your business. So you got money right here.
You just pay more now. Yeah. Which is just like it's when I see that stuff, because it doesn't make sense. It's not being done for a reason except for one where they're trying to get as much money as possible. Right.
Well, then they're not.
That always makes me unhappy.
Yeah. Because they're not selling you anything different.
No.
They're just charging.
But it might be that the only way you could actually sell that to a business, generally under the general corporate mindset, is actually to ratchet up the price.
Because they're like, oh, look at this high quality product.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think it's actually.
This thing costs $4 million a month. It must be really good.
Yeah. It's for like a price signaling thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think there is some of that per se. There.
It's just like.
Well, but their licensing makes it so that you have to. Because if it was if you could just pay more, like that was just an option. Like here's the enterprise version. It costs more. And that was the end of the story. Then I'd be like, fine.
That's the description by that.
Right.
It just costs more.
This is the same. But the licensing terms, like if you look at the licensing terms for most of these things that have a split level, right? It actually says if you are a business, you just can't. Right. So take like back when we finally got some Adobe products, because when Carol was redesigning our website, she was familiar with doing it in Photoshop.
Right, right, right.
And so we were like, well, it'll be much more cost effective just to like use the tools that you know. So we'll just, you know, go pay for a license. So I did, but I was like, we only need one person in the studio to do it, and like for a short period of time. And so I was like, well, I'll just go buy like a single person license to do that. Right. And so that's what I did. But when I was filling out the credit card info, it included the business name. Right. And I got a call from an Adobe person to the phone number I provided saying, hey, you're a business, so you actually can't use this license. You have to have the one that is for an entire year term that you cannot get out of unless you pay a $300 fee, so you can't get out of it early. That costs twice as much. It doesn't provide anything extra. It just costs twice as much.
Yep, Unity does the same thing. Yep. If you're a business, you have to lock into a one-year subscription at 100, like 100 something a month.
Yep.
Good times.
It's just frustrating.
And of course, I want to thank Yo-Yo Games
for not putting us through that. And frankly, anybody who's making a product and thinking about why you're doing it the way you are, and it's not, and the reason is a good one.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Yep.
Please do more of that.
Just keep doing that thing. All right, so we got time for one more question. This question comes from Degeki. He says, jumping gigawatts.
That an exclamation or a...
It's an exclamation.
Okay.
I believe it's from Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So many questions and comments here now. How does this make you feel? Have you had a celebrity at large moment where someone recognizes you on the street?
Mm.
So this is hilarious because you would think with... So now at this point, we have like 5 million something players, whatever.
Well, 13 million.
13 million pirates. Plus pirate, you know. Yeah. People have no idea who we are. Yeah. I think part of it is like kind of the author effect where, you know, we aren't entertainers. Right. We make a product that people buy and interact with. And so they recognize the product. The splash screen on the product only occurs for a few seconds the first time they boot it up. And most people only boot up the game once and then they just leave it on forever on their phone or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't really know generally, even if they have played our stuff, they don't know our studio name unless they're really paying attention. And they definitely don't know who we are mm-hmm. unless they go deeper, you know, through listening to the podcast or mm-hmm. check out our YouTube channel.
There's only one time that happened to me so far. I think it was like a month or two after Crashlands and I was going into the grocery store.
Right after game launches sometimes.
Yeah. I was going into the grocery store and I had my butterscotch shirt on and there's this like 14-year-old kid walking by and he just looked at me and his eyes got really big and he's like, butterscotch? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, and then he just ran away. And I was like, cool. So that was the one. And then, so we go to the Panera just right next to Seth's house pretty frequently. They're just kind of get out of the office or have a meeting or something. And so it was just 2 weeks ago we were in there. And of course, all three of us wear our butterscotch shirts often. And then, so we're always rolling with the squad whenever we go in there. So they kind of know that we're a bunch of weirdos. The thing is, most of them don't know what we do. They're just like, oh, the weirdos are back.
We're just very boisterous. Yeah. We just go there. We're like, hello.
So they're always giggling at us and stuff. But then the guy who brought our food over that we ordered was like, oh, you guys are butterscotch, right? And we're like, yeah. And was his wife played the game or something like that? He's like, oh, my wife plays the game. She loves it. It's so cool. So that happened. Yeah. But it's probably the most low key form of fame that you could.
Yeah. Watch. I mean, it's especially hilarious. Like we were at the PAX 10, right? And this is gamers. There's 80,000 people there and almost nobody who came by our booth, they knew who we were. They come by and they'd be like, what's this? Crashlands? What is that?
Yeah. Well, this is 6 months after Crashlands came out, right?
So the game had been out for quite a while.
Yeah.
So it's had time to bake.
Yeah. People are like, is this out yet? And I'm just sitting there like, fuck.
Yeah. Or we go to GDC. And the thing, you know, we try to do a lot of work to communicate with other developers, right? Mm-hmm. So we're always reaching out to developers. This podcast even is, you know, it's kind of aimed toward people who are interested, who are our game developers are interested in the dev side of things. And so we know we do have some like game dev podcast listeners. And even though we go to GDC, there's like 30,000 developers there. Sam gave mm-hmm. two talks there. Mm-hmm. We have all kinds of talks online, whatever. People, I would say 99%, like 1 out of 100 people we meet, even at GDC knows even vaguely.
My favorite thing was we sat down the day before GDC, we sent out an email to like, I think it was like a couple hundred people.
Yeah. There was a huge list of people who had specifically put their names into this list to be contacted mm-hmm. by other developers to meet up.
And so we just went through lists and it wasn't even form emails. It was like, we hand wrote emails to a big group of people who had things that they wanted to talk about that they had put up in this list. And we heard back from nobody.
Literally nobody replied. Nobody. We sent out, like 150 emails.
Hilarious.
Actually, that was our first day.
Yeah.
Was we all sat
down at a coffee shop and
there were like 300 people in this list. We sat down at a coffee shop and we split up the list between all seven of us mm-hmm. and we did research on everybody on the list to see like, what are they making? So we could send them a personalized email. Like what are they into? What do they want to talk about? Do we think that this would be like a good productive, you know, meeting or relationship for both of us? Mm-hmm. We did this for like 6 hours, mm-hmm. all seven of us together. So we put like 40 man hours into combing through this list and literally nobody replied.
Yeah.
So
yeah, nobody cares. I think it's probably the
nobody gives a nobody shit. Cares.
Which, you know, I think that's fine.
It's kind of refreshing.
It is refreshing because I think the nice thing about it is that
it helps us keep our egos.
Yeah, it keeps your ego checking. But then also, like, it's the quietest form of fame, such that every so often, like once a year, It's like a Christmas present when someone comes up and they're like, oh, you're with Butterscotch? And you're like, yeah. And they say, oh, did you make Crashlands? You're like, yeah. They're like, what did you do? You're like, I made the art for it. And they're like, whoa, that's great. And then they leave and that's it. That's like your one interaction you get for the year. But it feels like
But what you don't know is the people who don't approach you. You know, because I remember...
We saw Ashley Birch.
Yeah, we were at one of our first GDCs. Ashley Birch was there. And she's a YouTuber. She's hilarious. She also plays Tiny Tina in Borderlands. Mm-hmm. Just seems like an all-around just very cool person, right to know. And she was at GDC. I'm not quite sure what she was doing there, but probably Borderlands-related stuff. Yeah. And so we saw her just like at the food court at the mall across. Yeah. And
I mean, we had a brief conversation. We're like, we're
standing like 40 yards away.
And then she looked over. She looked over as if she heard. I made eye contact with her. I was like, ah! and then did like what that kid did. Yeah, just like run away.
And of course, like she's just a regular person, just being at an event or whatever. But I think part of it too is what do you say?
Yeah.
You know,
to me, that's always the big one is
right. Well, yeah.
Because like, from your perspective as a fan or, you know, whatever, like, What are you going to say to somebody who you are looking up to or who's made a thing that you really like that they haven't heard before? Or like, you're not going to start a new relationship with that person.
Oh, yeah, but even just saying that, like, it's just, you know, it's just like it is with any person or relationship you have. Or if someone comes up and very sincerely is like, hey, you know, thanks for doing that thing you did. That's super nice.
It is cool. It is cool.
But like, the question in my brain is always, then what?
Then what? Then you go, bye.
Then you flee while hyperventilating.
Yeah, it's not the opener that's the awkward part. It's then figuring out how to... Because, you know, of course, they've heard this. And so their response is always going to be, you know, thanks. I appreciate it.
But I think there's also a thing with, like, the depth of fandom, right? Because if you're a super fan, it gets scarier and scarier. But if you're an admirer, like, so somebody who's like, I played the shit out of Borderlands 2 forever ago with my wife, and we fucking loved all the Tiny Tina stuff. That was hilarious, right? So, like, for me, because I don't think I was there at that GDC, but if I were to see Ashley Birch, I'd be like, oh, yeah, she was the person who did the thing, right? And I would, like, kind of want to be like, hey, I loved what you did with that, right? But on the other hand, I also literally know nothing else about her.
Right.
And in fact, the only reason I even can remember her name right now is because you mentioned it. Like, that's my level of fandom, right? Because she's Tiny Tina. And so for me, it's like with those interactions, and because either I know somebody really well, and like I'm a serious fan, in which case then like it's too intimidating, or I only kind of know them, and then it's the same problem I always have when I can't remember somebody's name, but I know who they, I know they know me or something, and then I'm like, shit, I should just avoid the situation, right? That's the best move here.
My favorite Ashley Birch sketch, which I have to just close with. There's a lot of so she does a YouTube series called Hey Ash, What You Playing? Which is like, so like basically like a little mini,
hilarious
little short film.
And it's like her brother asks her that question at the beginning.
Yeah. So she'll be playing some game. Her brother comes like, hey, Ash, what you playing? And then she'll be like, Saints Row or whatever. And then the episode will sometimes like completely veer off the rails and it'll be somehow themed around what's happening.
Most of the time it veers off.
Right? And I think she was playing like Civilization or something. And then they ended up playing like the board game Risk or something like that. And she was playing the role of America, and she won the game by having like a 12 foot long dildo that she used to just sweep all the pieces off the board. It was very aggressive move.
Yeah. You gotta win.
Hey, you know, American Ford Posse, we give to it, so. Anyways. All right. So I think that's all the time we have. Thank you all for listening. We'd like to thank our studio wrangler Monique for putting this episode together, as well as our producer, Fat Bard, for making us sound good. And the Beast Gotcha dev team, Andy, Tifa, and Shure, for continuing to build stuff while we're in here chatting. We'd also like to thank our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And, of course, we'd like to thank you all, our listeners. We're coming back here every week to hear us pontificate about stuff and cheer us on. Also, if you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, hop into our Discord server, which you can find at bit.ly/bsdiscord. Come say hello. We're in there. And also, we have a mailbox. You can find it at mailbox.beastgotch.net. It's a literal physical mailbox. If you want to send us a 5-pound gummy bear, which has now happened.
Actually, we still have one of those, so don't do that
because that pile's going to get real big and heavy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just, you know, whatever. It's open. Also, we don't advertise this show, so we depend on word of mouth and good reviews. So if you want to help us grow the show, please tell your friends. Hit up Apple Podcasts. or wherever else you get your podcasts. Give us some stars, leave a little review, say some words. Every little bit helps. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.